hearers and doers. Susie and I, back in 1988, had a chance to go to the United States to a small groups conference. I was a small groups pastor at a big church at that time, and the conference was really wonderful. It was huge, 1,000 people were there, but pretty small, I think, by the standards of the American church at that time. And while we were there, we learned a lot about small groups, and that was fantastic. But the other thing that was interesting was a chance to visit some other congregations, some that we'd heard about. And I'd just like to tell you about two of those very briefly. One was a church, a traditional church, near Pasadena, where the conference was. And in that congregation, there was a reputation that they had a wonderful teaching program. So Susie and I went with great expectation. And as we got to the sermon, I was sort of a little bit disappointed. It was just a simple, encouraging homily. So after service, asked around, you know, what normally happens with the teaching. And they said, well, most of the people in this congregation have already sat through a Sunday school class for an hour before they came into the worship service. And then they went on and showed me the room where this Sunday school class occurred. I thought that all these adults would be sitting in rooms doing their colouring in, but that wasn't the case. It was a big auditorium, seated about 200 people. And the speaker was a well-known person at that time. It was a man called Peter Wagner. And Peter had been a professor of church growth at Fuller Seminary in Pasadena. So these people had had the teaching for over an hour from this wonderful, gifted speaker. And, of course, the sermon, its function at that time, was to inspire the worship. The other experience we had was to visit an Episcopalian Anglican church in Pasadena, All Saints Church in Pasadena. Very traditional Gothic structure, but the amusing part was it was all held together by big steel rods. It had been affected by many earthquakes. They had a staff of 8, a very big and prosperous church, but we arrived slightly early and discovered a large number of homeless people milling around on the lawn out the front. And they were being given a breakfast by the church community. So these are the two other images that we came with, and I give you these observations really to highlight what these congregations were doing, which was earnestly involved in understanding God's word and also giving practical expression to the gospel. Now, our attention today is on the end of chapter 1. For those who haven't been with us, we're working our way through the letter of James, and we've 3 weeks we've been looking at this now, and we've really only got to the end of chapter 1. So there's a lot more to go. It's one that draws our attention because it's, as we heard, one of those sentences in the reading today. It's a real strong injunction from James in there that says, be hearers of the word, not only hearers of the word, but be both hearers and doers of the word. Putting it another way, the readers are to be informed by the word in order to be transformed in the thoughts and action. These things are both sides of the one coin. Now, I'm conscious that most of us at some time or another have heard sermons based on this part of the letter of James. And I'm hoping that you will keep your mind open and begin the process of making decisions about what you'll do with the information that you get Sunday from Sunday. And be affirmed about the ways you might strive to live Christianly day by day in response to what we've heard. Now, I'm going to ask you, if you would like to follow this, is to keep the James section open, James chapter 1, verses 19 through 27, because I'm not actually going to reread the verses. If you want to just check what I'm talking to, I'll give you the verse numbers, but you might glance at them as we go. I'm going to let you see that there's a simple structure that goes with these verses. It's in three stages, and the first one, it really is, like we heard in the gospel, growing as a disciple, and you'll hear how these steps go. First, we're going to be looking at what James says about being able to hear the word. The second is about receiving it, and the third is about obeying it, putting it all into action. Kyria, could you tap the... we move us forward one, please. Maybe another. There we go. So there are the three steps, three stages that we're going to look at, which is the way that James has structured his comments about being not only hearers but doers of the word. Anyone who's been in the business of communication knows that the principal aim is to ensure that the information that is sent by the speaker is also what is received by the hearer. So what does James consider will get in the way of this process happening, of hearing the word? A person is unable to hear if the following problems seem to be present and get in the way to listening to each other and to listening to God. And these are the things that he talks about, beginning at verse 19. To listen, the person needs to stop talking. Now there's an injunction for you. Stop talking. Because when you are speaking, you are not listening. Similar idea in Proverbs 10:19 says, for example, when words are many, transgression is not lacking. I better keep this sermon short. Again, in Psalm 64, this whole business about being slow to speak is reflected, I think, in Psalm 64, verse 30, be still and know that I am God. You can't be still if you're talking. The second thing that James alludes to is a person can't hear God if they are angry. It seems quite obvious, but it is important to state it. Anger does not produce God's righteousness. So if you want to hear from God, you can't be angry. And third, what he goes and says in verses 19 to 20, a person cannot hear God if they knowingly persist in sinful ways. There is another way, you know, if you engage in too much talking and it can get in the way of the message and the way it's received. James's injunction to be slow to speak may be aimed at ensuring thoughtful speech. Is there time enough to appreciate the impact of the words that you use? I'm going to read you a small account from an interesting man called Lawrence Crabb. Lawrence Crabb was a Christian psychologist and was very influential in helping people with his writings and his lectures. And he gives an account of this process of thoughtful speech, so that the person who is listening can really get the right message and be encouraged. The book is called Encouragement. This was and he was a young man in his home church. It was customary in our congregation to encourage young men to enter into the privilege of worship by standing and praying aloud. That particular Sunday, I sensed the pressure of the saints, nor I fear the leading of the Spirit, and I responded by unsteadily leaving my chair for the first time with the intention of praying. Filled less with worship than with nervousness, I found my theology becoming confused to the point of heresy. I remember thanking the Father for hanging on the cross and praising Christ for triumphantly bringing the Spirit from the grave. Stuttering throughout, I finally thought of the word Amen, perhaps the first evidence of the Spirit's leading. Said it and sat down. I recall vowing never again to pray or speak aloud in front of a group. Two strikes were enough. The other one was his chronic stuttering. When the service was over, I darted toward the door, not wishing to encounter an elder who might feel obliged to correct my twisted theology, but was not quick enough. An old Christian man named Jim Dunbar intercepted me, put his arm on my shoulder, cleared his throat to speak. I remember thinking to myself, here it comes, oh well, just endure it and then get to the car. I then listened to this godly gentleman speak words that I can repeat verbatim today, more than 20 years later. "Larry," he said, "there's one thing I want you to know. Whatever you do for the Lord, I'm behind you 1,000%. Then he walked away. Crabb goes on and talks in this little book about words of life and words of death. And he received from Jim Dunbar the words of life. And I think you can read between the lines that was instrumental in forming his career and his ability to do what he did. First step was about listening and hearing. The second step that James in his letter talks about, or it's not actually stated, but we can read it as we look at the verses, it's about reception, about receiving the word. Verse 21 has this. And it's not only about being able to listen and hear others, but to hear from God. And in a way that it's very personal, a very personal connection with God. Again, it's conditional. It's not about God on demand. It's about being in the right place, the right state to hear from God. And as the text says, welcome with meekness the implanted word. This implies a degree of intimacy with God in the communication, and it's echoed in Jeremiah's prophecy, which I'll read, Jeremiah 31, 33, 34, the verses. I will put my law in their mind and write it on their hearts. No longer will a man teach his neighbour or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they will know me. A very intimate connection there between God and the person. There is the suggestion that in receiving the word, it's incorporated into the whole being of the person. This is what we mean by reception. It's not kept hidden in some remote part of our mind. In our reading from Job this morning, we read of the dramatic and terrifying way in which Elihu speaks to Job and describes the way God speaks in the night through dreams and visions and terrifies them with warnings. In the early days of theological education in the Northern Territory, I heard a speaker mention something which stayed in my mind, and I'll share it with you now. It was that when Aboriginal communities came together to study their theology and their Christian doctrine, they would do an intensive for 3 weeks. And then they would leave the college. We might say they would go on a spiritual walkabout. The process of doing that was to work through the things that they had learned. And it always struck me that in our theological colleges, we go from a lecture on Old Testament to a lecture on Greek to a lecture on New Testament to a lecture on ethics, all in the course of before lunch. There's not a lot of time to receive what you've heard. We seem to often want to shun new ideas and stop them from coming through. And I think that's because we have been so trained in our everyday life to keep ourselves closed from all the forces that try to convince us of new ideas, new products to buy, new ways to spend your money and so on. And we've been dealing with those over the years, and they've really become part of our defence mechanisms. Now, I'm just wondering, are we in this place so that we now stand at the door of new ideas, fearful of opening it just a little? Because if we do, the light of the new thinking will burst in and flood our comfortable state, and our world will not be the same. We tend to quarantine new ideas out of a fear of change sometimes. And I think that we can only pray that God in his mercy will open up our hearts and minds to receive that which he wants to give us. We reach the final phase of James's special injunction about not only being hearers and doers, Remember, it began with the need to remove the blocks that prevent a person from hearing. Second, there was the need to move from the head to the heart, as we've just mentioned. And finally, the response is to obey. And he begins with, "But be doers of the word and not merely hearers," verse 22. But how does a person become a doer of the word? It's most likely that James would have been quite familiar with Jesus' parable about the wise and foolish builders, for example. This is a parable about obedience. Everyone who hears the words of mine and acts or obeys them will be like the wise man who built his house on a rock. The audience that he's speaking to, the scattered churches in the Greco-Roman Empire, the audience understands that they need to hear, receive, and obey in order to be good disciples. But what does obedience really look like? Well, we first get a sense of what it doesn't look like in the things that he writes. James uses a simple analogy of the fleeting glimpse of yourself in a mirror. Now, I think that some of that analogy is a bit lost on us at the moment because we're just so saturated by very high quality mirrors that reflect our image back to us umpteen times a day. Sometimes it's a frightening experience, and I remember looking in the mirror and seeing the face of my father in the mirror, and I knew, "Greg, you're now 60. But in the time that this was written, we didn't have this constant reminder of what our image looks like. Instead, they were the highly polished brass plates or a still clear pool. And you could get a glimpse of what you looked like, but it wouldn't be constantly reinforced. It would be an imperfect mirror and only a glimpse soon forgotten. The analogy is used to highlight the negative in order to accentuate the positive. I think I've heard those words in a song. A person looks in the mirror, observes, then forgets, is what he says. But in contrast, the good disciple looks into the law of God and continues in its company, then acts. The final step in James' exhortation focuses on true religion, verses 26 and 27. And it's a positive example of what it means not only to be hearers of the word, but doers. The word religion is not defined really here, but it's reasonable to assume that it's the outward expression of what is going on in your inner spiritual self. And we might get confused with our modern understanding of the word religion, which is in common usage, and it's really about the formal practice of traditions and ceremonies associated with a particular faith. But in this text, it's reinforcing the importance that true religion is not about superficial acts or formal outward observances. The person whose religious experience is genuine will put spiritual truth into practice. We would say today that our outward actions are congruent with the heart, what the heart believes and knows. This is true religion. We can imagine James saying at this point, "In case you don't know what this looks like, it's about the life that expresses itself in love for others, such as caring for widows and orphans, the most vulnerable people, and keeping unstained by the world, avoiding being polluted by the world." That's the way he finishes his injunction about the need to be doers. It must be seen in actions. Well, we've done our bit about listening. So how can we experience what James has been talking about? Some may be able to come to great changes in the way they live and think and believe just by thinking about it. And I think the classic example of this is C.S. Lewis, who basically talked himself into faith. But for the rest of us, maybe the rest of us, there might be some who have great intellectual capacity and can work these things out for themselves. But the other place to do that is in the context of being in a group with others. A good small group studies scriptures with a view of not only being informed about what the word says, but being transformed by it. And the other good thing about a small group is that it's got this atmosphere of trust. And if you want to experiment with the doing, you've got a safe place to do it. So I'd encourage us all to continue in small groups, either in the church or in other places that you are in. To finish, I'm wondering if it hadn't occurred to you already that there is a catch to today's message. Now that we've listened to the injunction to be doers and not just hearers, we may well ponder, how do we respond to what we've heard today? How do we act on it? How do we receive it? And I'm wondering whether we need to go on a bit of a spiritual walkabout ourselves over this coming week. As part of that, if you wanted to continue your thinking, there are the studies in James, which are up there on the back there, and if your group is studying them, then you can prepare for that, or you can do it by yourselves. Many years ago, I read of a legend regarding the Apostle John. It seemed that he lived to a very old age. And each time the assembly met, they asked him to offer them a word. And each time he would slowly rise to his feet and he would say, "Love one another." Then he would sit down. One can't help but feel that he could say no more until the assembly understood what he said the last time. Amen.